In the course of erasing important achievements of the past, what you're doing is you're encouraging people to forget what the past was really all about. And already we're seeing a situation where we no longer remember what Aristotle is, because we're told that Aristotle is this founder of white supremacy. Essentially, a kid going to school today will be told that Churchill was a war criminal. And when you have that kind of vision of the greatest icon of 20th century British history, then you don't remember very much about where you've come from.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Frank Faraday. Frank, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to talk to you.
So Frank, let's talk about your new book, The War Against the Past, Why the West Must Fight for Its History. It's a really good read. There's so much stuff in there, lots of things I want to ask you about. But I guess I'll start off with a broad question. You kick off the book with a really dramatic image of a statue of Abraham Lincoln being dragged down in Portland during the BLM riots of 2020. And it is a very useful reminder of just how physical the war against the past has become over the past few years. And you describe it almost like a second assassination of Lincoln, like a lynch mob who had invaded the past to exact revenge on the present. It's really, really excellently described. But it's interesting that you open with that, because the argument you make in the book is that actually this war against the past has been gathering pace for quite some time. And I think to some of us, it looks like it really exploded around 2020 with the dragging down of statues and the obsession with slavery and so on. But it's been coming for some time. So could you just say a bit about what you think its origins are? How long has this war been fought against the past, against our history?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that ever since the 1970s, there's been a cumulative process whereby Western society, particularly in the Anglo-American world, became more and more distant from its own past. And you always have that trend in modern times where people criticize the past. They sometimes lash out against something that has happened before. But what's very interesting was that from the early 1980s onwards, the attacks on the past were very rarely resisted by the cultural and political establishment in these countries. So usually stand up and do their best to basically talk about how important it is to preserve the memory of the past, to take that legacy seriously. And instead, what happens is that more and more, you get even these elites being disenchanted and estranged from their own past. So what happens is that there is literally a one-sided war against the past. There's very little defense. I mean, there are some books written in response. But when you add up the scale of the attacks, the number of individuals involved in calling into question the integrity of Western civilization and its defenders, it's a very one-sided affair. And what happens is that what begins as a kind of quite specific targeted attacks on maybe on slavery in America, or attacking how the British Empire behaved in the 19th, early 20th century, very targeted attacks, suddenly, from around 1915, 16 onwards, everything, every dimension of the Western experience is rendered toxic. And it's almost as if what they're trying to do is to contaminate that legacy of the past, to throw a quarantine around it to suggest that there is no redeeming feature, that this is a story of shame. And that obviously kicks in 2020, but it's been a long time coming, and the ground has been prepared for that over the previous decade.
Yeah, it's really important, I think, to, and your book does this, to really think about the role of the elites in the war against the past. Because I think to some people, it will look like it is a kind of street level, some people might even see it as a grassroots campaign, you know, particularly after 2020, you know, we associate it with the people who dragged down the statue of Abraham Lincoln, or of the slave guy in Bristol, where they dragged down his statue and threw it into the river. Or, you know, students at Oxford saying, we've got to get rid of this statue of Rhodes, because it's really offending me and stressing me out on my way to class. Or, you know, students, I think it was at a Cambridge college, who said they couldn't have a picture of the Queen in the common room because it reminded them of empire. You know, there is this tendency to associate that allergy to the past with maybe, you know, naive, young, radical types, but it has become very much an elite project. And in the book, you really run through lots of instances where some of the highest seats of learning in the world, great museums like the British Museum, various art galleries have affected or not necessarily affected, but adopted this attitude of shame towards the past and towards their own artifacts, towards their own collections, towards their own traditions, the traditions of which they themselves have been born. So talk to us a little bit about how that elite involvement in antagonism towards the past, how does that get started? When does that come about? And what do you think underpins a situation where even the Western elites have turned against Western history itself?
Well, I think what happens is that at a certain point, the new establishment in Anglo-American societies ceases to believe in the values and the ideals of their parents and their ancestors. And in the course of becoming skeptical about everything that is part of their kind of cultural inheritance, they begin to become more and more cynical. And that cynicism at a certain point becomes so rigid that it acquires a very hostile orientation. So increasingly, what I call the good old days, that nostalgic view of the past, gets displaced by rendering it the bad old days. And I cite a speech by David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, I think it was in 2012, who, after a racist incident, basically said, we don't want to go back to the bad old days of racism. And that statement was really interesting, because here you have the conservative prime minister of Britain talking about the past as the bad old days rather than as the good old days. And what he's really saying is that there is something inherently negative. And the impulse to nullify the past, which he articulated, by that point is fairly widely shared across the political divide between the elites of both parties. And of course, it's totally institutionalized within universities and even schools and other cultural institutions. So what you have is a kind of a gradual process where that sentiment becomes common sense, and it's taken for granted that when you begin to represent the past, it's very rare that you're going to do it in a positive, within a positive frame.
Yeah, I did want to ask you about the momentum behind the war against the past before we get into the kind of meat of it and what it represents, because you start the book by saying, there was no formal declaration of war, no gunshots rang out, it didn't even make the local news, but nonetheless, a war against the past has obviously started and is obviously in full flow. And you talk about how the culprits in this war, the protagonists in this war, they're hard to pin down. It's not exactly a conscious element. You make the point this is not a conspiracy. It's not as if members of the elite got together and said, you know, let's launch a war against the past. There was nothing like that. But nonetheless, over time, it became a very real, palpable thing. If you go into a museum now, you will see shamefaced notices attached to certain artifacts saying, you know, we probably shouldn't have this in our museum and we might hide it away at some point in the future because it comes from the colonial era. But here you go, have a look at it for now. And as a consequence, going to a museum becomes a very dispiriting experience. So you see the war against the past manifested in various different ways, in popular culture, in museums, in the education system. But it can be difficult to pin down the protagonists, the sense of momentum, what's driving it, and so on. And you will be aware that if you talk about a war against the past, people will think that you're pushing a conspiracy theory, or you're imagining that there is this secret elite who are dismantling the past brick by brick. So how would you describe the process itself to those who know that something's happening, but at the same time recognize that no war has been declared and there's no clear aims to it?
Well, the way that I understand it is that at a certain point, when as political ideologies begin to evaporate, and as the conservative sections of society give up on the past, and the left kind of gives up on the future, and you have this establishment of a very powerful presentist mode where, in a sense, we're kind of trapped in the present. There is no future-oriented movement or parties or very, you know, only on the margins. And at the same time, people find it very difficult on the conservative section of society to genuinely uphold the past. What you then end up is a gradual breaking down in people's mind of the temporal distinction between the past and the present and the future. And when you have that, we kind of living in the ever-present, you know, it becomes quite tempting to establish a degree of moral authority to basically demonstrate what a great person you are by criticizing an icon from the past, like Churchill or Shakespeare, and or alternatively, by almost like fixing the problem of the past. So there's a kind of tendency increasingly of having these ritualistic kind of caricatured attempts to almost like fix the problems of the past, which is much easier, at least imaginatively, than to practically fix the problems of the present, which is why you have a situation, I think you probably saw the other week, where the National Gallery in London decides that one of Constable's most famous painting needs a sign that basically explains that this beautiful painting of a rural, idyllic situation is one thing, but the reality is that there are a lot of poor people who are living in poverty in the villages of England in the 18th century who Constable didn't paint. So what they are saying is, you know, I don't care about the painting. That's of no interest to me. What I'm interested in is making a statement about the fact that Constable did not paint the picture that I want him to paint. And they do that with everybody. Shakespeare's plays, the vocabulary is changed because people feel that Shakespeare's racist ideals need to be brought out. And Shakespeare's language was too subtle for that. So they're going to turn the language into a more racist kind of vocabulary. And in that way, they kind of rewrite Shakespeare, fix the problem of Shakespeare. And they also arrogantly assume that they understand better than Shakespeare did about what he meant when he wrote the play. So that kind of temporal breakdown of the distinction between the present and the past allows people to almost obsess and to find a focus for their energies, which they are not able to make much of in the present contemporary era.
That's a really well put. And I want to come back to that question of presentism and the ideology of year zero that you devote one of the chapters to. But first, I just want to ask you, one of your first chapters, I think it might be the first one, is called What is the Past? And I did want you just to, it seems like an obvious question, you know, the past is stuff that happened before yesterday, I guess. But I did want to just get you to outline that a bit, because one question I did want to ask you in relation to how we define the past, and you've already touched on this in what you've been saying, but there are people who will say, look, we're just targeting the terrible stuff in the past. Like, people do talk about slavery quite a lot, for example. They talk about empire, the excesses of empire, colonialism, the brutalism of colonialism that often occurred. I mean, if you go to Ireland, which I do quite often, they're obsessed with all the awful things from the past, the famine, the excesses of British rule, the Catholic Church, the Magdalene laundries, and they will say, look, we're just talking about the terrible things that happened, you know, and we should acknowledge, they will say, that terrible things happened in the past, even if good things happened as well. You've already touched on the fact that actually that quite quickly develops into an antagonism to the past in general. But how do you work through that accusation, I guess, that someone might say to you, listen, Frank, loads and loads of really awful things happened in the past. Millions of people were killed. It was terrible. So even if you want to defend the past, you have to acknowledge that it had some sinful, problematic behavior as well. So how do you factor that into your understanding of what the past means as an idea?
Well, the past obviously has got its negative downside. You know, human history has got its blemishes and its misdeeds. There's no doubt about it. But I think there's a difference between the way that people attacked the negative features of previous societies and today. So, for example, you had a situation where the French revolutionaries basically set up a calendar, a new calendar beginning with year one, and they basically were extremely hostile to many of the features of monarchical absolutism, and they attacked it. But as even Karl Marx conceded, that when the revolutionaries in France, you know, made their revolution, they did it in the close of the Roman Empire and the Roman Republic. In other words, they had these heroes that inspired that revolution from the previous eras. They were very selective in what those heroes were, but that was the case. And the communist movement in the 20th century attacked everything about the Industrial Revolution, capitalism, almost everything. But they still had heroes like Spartacus and other kind of rebels that existed in the past. Today, you know, when you attack the British Empire for its slavery and when you say that America is the worst place in the world, no better than Nazi Germany, the people who are on the forefront of this, you know, are not saying, but we have this hero from before, or we are inspired by this experience from the past, because everything from the Greeks, ancient Greece, the Renaissance, Enlightenment, it's all tarred with the brush of white supremacy. So this is a very big difference. They're not just simply saying that humanity has done some very bad things in previous times. What they are really saying is that everything that happened in the past, the very past itself, which happened before us, should be written off and should be seen in negative terms, and a health warning should be attached to it. And I can give you loads of examples where relatively uncontroversial things or features of the past are now denounced. You know, you can have a Greek sculpture in a museum, and just a Greek sculpture, but because it's white, people say, well, that Greek sculpture is in the museum. The reason why it's white was as to serve as a signal of white supremacy, that already these ancient Greeks, who were almost like the Ku Klux Klan of the 20th century, but didn't know it.
Most of us like to believe that all our information can be kept private when we're online. We think that it's up to us how much of our personal life we share with the world. But what if I told you that actually the opposite was true? Right now, your personal data is likely being published or even sold on the internet, all without you even knowing. Global data breaches happen all the time. That means that data brokers can easily take advantage and sell your exposed personal details to businesses. And if that wasn't bad enough, this info can even fall into the hands of criminals. The good news is that you can demand that data brokers delete all the information they hold about you. The bad news is it would take years to do this manually. So to protect myself from brokers and criminals alike, I've started using Incogni. Incogni is a service that reaches out to data brokers on your behalf and demands that they remove your personal details. It fights any objections on their end and conducts automatic repeated removal requests, effectively protecting you from the next big data breach. This might all sound a bit complicated, but the best thing about Incogni is that it is incredibly easy to set up. All you have to do is create an account, grant Incogni the right to work for you, and then leave them to it. And if you think that data breaches couldn't possibly impact on you, think again. The number of data breach victims has nearly doubled in the last 5 years, and the consequences can be devastating. Criminals can take out huge loans under your name, and scammers can even use AI to mimic your voice and scam your loved ones. It really is that serious. So if you want to protect your personal information, get started with Incogni today. To get 60% off an annual Incogni plan, use the code Brendan at incogni.com/Brendan. That's the code Brendan at incogni.com/Brendan. Incogni.com/Brendan. Okay, I want to ask you about the paradoxical relationship many of us have with the past these days. And you do discuss this in the book, because it does seem amongst younger activists in particular, there is simultaneously an antagonism towards the past and a hatred of the past and a fear of it, while at the same time a kind of rummaging through the past for an explanation for every problem that afflicts you in the present. So not only do they feel very alienated from the past and hostile to many of its gains and ideas, but they also constantly venture into the past to look for the reason why their life isn't working in the present. So, you know, if you look at the historical determinism that surrounds the idea of the discussions of slavery, for example, where you will have many young activists today who will say that Black people in the West right now, the reason their lives are a mess is because of the impact of slavery, the shadow of slavery, the financial problems associated with our societies as a consequence of slavery. So we have to give them reparations. We have to give them this kind of therapeutic fix to address the problems that they inherit from the past. So it's a kind of sometimes feels like a contradictory process, where you have activists who go looking for an explanation for their lives in the past, while at the same time waging war against the past and feeling very hostile to it. How do you explain that seeming paradox?
Well, it is a paradox, because on the one hand, you want to break from the past. At the same time, you are continually colonizing the past, almost as if you're moving into the past to discover yourself. And I think the reason for that is many, but the most important reason is that you cannot have the kind of politicization of identity that we have today. You cannot have that identity obsession that we have in 21st century society without finding some kind of link with the past. So you have a situation where trans activists are essentially working as grievance archaeologists, yeah. and they're determined to find some precedent for their trans identity, and they will go back all the way to the Egyptian civilization. And you have the situation where a lot of trans activists who are discussing with archaeologists are saying it's entirely wrong that when you find a human remain in a pyramid in Egypt, to call that human remain a she or a he, because you have no idea how they would identify. Mm. So the idea being that already in ancient Egypt, people would say, I identify as, you know, rather than, you know, take for granted that you're a woman or a man. So you have this kind of reading history backwards, where you're continually looking for evidence of some sort that can normalize your claims, and at the same time, you know, sort of provide you with sufficient historical authority to suggest that it's always been like this. You know, people have always been trans, you know, and it was denied, you know, in recent times. But now with the latest version of the trans sort of individuals that lived 2,000-3,000 years ago. So it's a kind of obsessive way of flattering yourself by using history as a resource to give your identity some kind of moral content.
That's well put. And yeah, and it does feel contradictory at times, but it makes sense. There's this kind of almost, you know, they talk about cultural appropriation, but there's this historical appropriation where you kind of wear the garments of the past as a way of giving your identity in the present a bit more depth, I guess. And it seems like a pretty desperate state of affairs. I wanted to ask you more about the ideology of Year Zero, which you've touched on already, and the cult of presentism, and just looking at what that means. You have this really good phrase in the book where you talk about the eternalization of the present. And you've already mentioned how you have a situation where even Shakespeare can be improved upon or corrected by the Year Zero ideologues of 2024. And you constantly have a situation where old, dead, white men are being corrected or having little notices attached to their statues to say how problematic they were. You know, Hume, the Hume Tower in Edinburgh renamed because apparently he had racist views. Even Aristotle has been dragged before the kangaroo court of, you know, the Year Zero ideologues and made to answer for his outdated views. I wanted to press you on what you think that represents, because there's such an extraordinary arrogance to it, you know, that almost like we are morally perfect right now, so morally perfect that we have the right to go back in time and judge people by their failed values and the fact that they didn't think exactly like we do. So there is an extraordinary arrogance to it. But how does that sit with the crisis of legitimacy or the crisis of authority that seems to drive the war against the past more broadly? So again, it seems like a contradictory process where on the one hand, we think, you know, we're so wonderful, we're so trans friendly, and we're so anti-racist and all these kind of great claims that people make that we have the right to go back to the 1500s and, you know, even pre-Christ and hold everyone to account. But at the same time, there is this kind of discomfort with Western civilization and this discomfort with Western history itself that makes people want to throw things at the past and insult the past as well. How do you explain that process?
I think that's fairly simple. Basically, what's being said here is that I'm a better person than people that lived before. In other words, you're not just simply saying something that is obvious, that we know more than people who lived 2,000 years ago. And that, I mean, we certainly don't say that we're the beneficiaries of the experience of the last 2,000 years and we stand on the shoulders of giants. What you say instead is that I, you know, an ordinary individual sitting in my digital bedroom, are a better person than a playwright or a philosopher or an icon of history that lived in the past. And in a sense, that's why you get this. And the thing is that you can only establish that kind of sensibility, not by what you've done in the present, but by basically, in a sense, negating, demonizing the past and drawing a moral contrast between yourself, a very aware 24th century individual, and this insensitive, you know, sort of oppressive individual living in the past. And that moral contrast and the drawing of that moral contrast is really very, very crucial in order to give some kind of legitimacy to the little things that you're doing in the here and now. Because suddenly, you know, sort of for the first time in history, you know things that nobody else could possibly understand. And therefore, in the very act of projecting your mind back to the past and reading history backwards and fixing the problems that those people couldn't really fix or couldn't really understand, you kind of create a certain kind of a degree of authority, at least for yourself. And I think that's one of the most important drivers that's happening at the moment. And that kind of feeds this demand for the moral resources, which identity politics cannot draw on from the present. They got to find it from a source that's external to itself.
I wanted to ask you about when the war against the past gets particularly irrational. I mean, the whole thing has an irrational feel to it at the best of times, but there are moments when it feels almost like a process of exorcism, you know, exorcising some kind of demon from history or from the public space in the terms of statues and so on, in order to make one feel better or in order to demonstrate the fact, as you say, that we are superior people. I am a superior individual. So if you think about the anti-Rhodes movement in Oxford, for example, and there was one in South Africa as well. I mean, the way some of those young students and campaigners talked about the statue of Cecil Rhodes in Oxford was extraordinary. They called it an environmental microaggression. They said it was an act of violence, you know, as if walking past a statue was physically hurtful. And there was this real, something almost pre-political or post-political, I'm not sure which one, urge to tear down this statue in order to alleviate some kind of pain these people claimed to be feeling. And, you know, I did a radio discussion once and about this issue, and someone was saying to me, do you agree that we should remove the statue of Cromwell from Westminster, given the terrible things he did in Ireland? And I said, no, I don't agree with that, because he was an important historical figure in terms of British democracy and British politics. And there was this real shock that you wouldn't share in this instinctual urge, this desire to cleanse the public space of problematic figures from the past. So it does sometimes feel quite irrational, like there's this kind of bizarre lust to wipe away anything that feels wrong or demonic from the past. It sometimes feels like it really could cross the line almost into a Taliban territory, where you have the smashing of statues in order to satisfy an ideological requirement in the 21st century.
Well, it is not unlike the Taliban experience. Obviously, it's expressed in a more moderate Western language. But you have to remember that for these people, you know, when they criticize Hume or when they criticize Shakespeare or Rhodes, they aren't just criticizing somebody who's physically distant from them. They almost treat them as if they are alive and they are their contemporaries. And that's really where the irrational side enters into it, because it's one thing to have an intellectual conversation with Machiavelli and yet you debate his writings. It's quite another thing where you basically assume the role of a moral teacher and you basically give these people a lesson. You basically sit down with Shakespeare and say, why did you write this? And, you know, why did you say these things? You know, and why, you know, and you basically interrogate them as if they're sitting in front of you. That's really where the irrationality kind of begins to kick in. And once you've got this approach, once you erode the temporal distinction between the present and the past, then your attitude towards the symbols of the past, every symbol of the past, becomes even more irrational. I mean, you talk about the irrationality of lashing out at a statue of Rhodes, that's nothing. That's very limited in comparison to what's going on in Wales at the moment, where you basically call buildings racist. And it's almost like you give this these physical material objects a kind of life. You kind of bring them to life in a kind of biblical sense. And suddenly, you know, you have a situation where buildings and rooms and material and things with entirely only material properties all of a sudden are brought into life in a way that is almost like fetishistic, really fetishistic. And that kind of irrationality, I think, goes way beyond the outlook of the Taliban or ISIS or any of these crazy movements that were in the business of smashing statues.
Yeah. I want to ask you about what happens when we eternalize the present. What are the consequences of presentism? So you talk about, in the book, you talk about the eternalization of the present, and you talk about how this leads to the erosion of temporal boundaries, which is a really interesting phrase in that chapter where you discuss some of the consequences of this approach. And it does often strike me that, and you've talked about this many times before, that we live in an era in which people feel alienated from the past or even hostile to the past and very fearful of the future. You know, who knows what the future holds with climate change and viruses and diseases and all the other apocalypses that are continually being predicted. So people don't look at the past as a source of real moral inspiration or political inspiration in the way that they might have done in the past. And at the same time, they don't dream about the future except to have nightmares about the end of the world and the death of a billion people as a consequence of modern industrial society. What happens when you only live in the present in terms of not only physically, we all live in the present physically, but mentally, morally, intellectually? Presentism is a prison, isn't it, really, in terms of what it does to the individual and what it does to our sense of ourselves as civilized beings who are connected to the past and have a relationship with the future?
Well, I mean, what you're describing is a trap. When you're trapped in the present and when there's no possibility of somehow getting out of that trap, you basically give up on changing or being able to change your circumstances. You basically assume that this is it. And therefore, there is no possibility of creating a different world. That's why I use the term the ever-present, where the present just gets expanded into the future and into the past. And that is why, first of all, you're a situation where there are no future-oriented projects. I mean, political parties and movements very rarely talk about changing the world in any important sense. They very rarely, you know, sort of have a political program that imaginatively demonstrates to people the kind of world we could be living in, the kind of steps that need to be taken. But at the same time as writing of the future and more or less resigning yourself to the world being what it is at the moment, what you also do is you become so cut off from the past that you haven't really got any kind of clear guidelines about how to interact and behave on a day-to-day basis. So if you lost the past and you haven't got a set of guidelines, taking for granted assumptions, then life becomes very confusing because you got to make up rules as you go along. There's nothing you can draw on. And that particularly has an impact on young people who, you know, are not able to sort of have any organic relationship to anything that has gone and preceded their own lives.
I wanted to come on to the question of young people and I guess the question of what it means to grow up without the sense of history that older generations may have grown up with. Although you say that the war against the past has been coming for some time, there are older generations who remember what it was like to be taught to respect the wisdom of their elders or to understand the history of their nation or of their community in order to give them a sense of connection that they just, I guess, as Kamala Harris might say, they didn't fall out of a coconut tree. You know, that none of us did, and we're all connected to the past in some way or other. I think older people have that sense, even if it might be waning and even if it might be under strain from the crusade against the past that's currently taking place. But what does it mean to be a young person in school right now or going to university and your inner world in which, as you say in the book, you are being disinherited from your past? What impact is that likely to have on the future generation? I mean, how is that likely to play out in these kids' lives as they get older and as they feel disinherited from the past, fearful of the future? What kind of citizen is created through that process, do you think?
I think a very fragile citizen, because once you become disconnected from everything that's preceded you, then you're in a situation where you haven't got a kind of moral or intellectual or civilizational support system that you can draw on. Now, it doesn't mean to say that, you know, you have to accept everything that is part of that support system, but at least you can pick and choose. You can decide which bits of that legacy you want to make your own and run with and develop into your own individual identity. And one of the things that occurs is when you haven't got that, then your very identity formation, where you begin to have a sense of yourself, know who you are, becomes essentially compromised. You know, if you're not, if there's no transmission of the past and the experience of the past to the next generation, then invariably you create a what is very evidently an identity crisis. Now, most of the time when young people have an identity crisis, they can easily overcome that because eventually by you know, by struggling with the older generations, by learning from the older generations, they somehow overcome that identity crisis. But when the older generation itself hasn't got a story to tell them and is itself insecure about its relation to the past, or even worse, has become very cynical about the past, then, of course, that identity crisis doesn't get resolved. There is no possibility for that. And I think that's the reason why we see in many, many parts of the Western world a growing tendency to misdiagnose that identity crisis that young people suffer from as a mental health problem, and not understand that behind the mental health problem rise this loss of civilizational connection. I think that's the key. I think that's what creates the issue, rather than anything to do with the social media or anything contemporary. It's that fundamental breakdown of the transmission of the legacy of the past to generation, which has got a huge, incredibly big impact on undermining the young the ways of life of the young people.
On the transmission of the legacy of the past, it's a very powerful part of your book. You talk about it in some detail in all the chapters, I suppose. I wanted to ask you how you make the case for that today. Because it was traditionally seen as a conservative project, but I don't mean conservative in a pejorative sense. I mean, you know, education has long had a very conservative element to it, in terms of it's about conserving the gains of history and communicating them to the new generation. I guess the question I'm going to ask you is, would you say that your resistance of the war against the past, would you describe it as a conservative project? Is this the situation you now find yourself in, where you feel you have to take a pretty conservative position in relation to this anarchic, sometimes quite tyrannical destruction of the gains of Western civilization, that we do actually need to take a conserving approach that holds up those great gains of the past and quite confidently passes them on to the next generation? How would you describe that project politically?
Well, you know, conserving the past, or conserving the legacy of the past, is really important. But historically, the pursuit of that endeavor was not simply confined to people who were politically conservative, because you could go to left-wing working-class communities in many parts of Europe, where the older generations would tell stories about their fathers and grandfathers who went to work in the mill, who talked about the formation of trade unions, who talked about, you know, sort of the ways of their community, so that those young kids growing up had something very clear picture that they could interact with, and there would be that organic connection with something that has been conserved. Now, what I'm really saying here is that when that project of conserving the past is now regarded as in a negative manner, then we have a problem. But yes, I do think that, you know, part of what we have to do is to reappropriate the past, to conserve what is really, really good about it, and to ensure that in some shape or form, we provide the younger generations with a degree of, with a sense of historical continuity. And in the course of giving them that sense of historical continuity, then we can have a conversation about what it is that we want to continue with. And that's something that is an open question, but it's a creative question. And that's really how you can begin to build a much more robust defense of our valuable cultural resources that we mustn't lose in this war.
The other area I wanted to touch on with you is the question of historical truth, I guess. Or the question of what history... So we've talked a bit about the impact that presentism can have on our sense of selves, on our sense of our existence as civilized members of a civilization connected to the past and related to the future. But what impact does the war against the past have on historical memory, I guess, or historical truth, or our ability to understand the past? So it seems like we talk about the past all the time. It's everywhere you look. People are saying, look at this awful thing that happened in 500 years ago. Look at this terrible thinker from 2000 years ago. It's all around us. But our understanding of the past is declining all the time. So if you think about, for example, you mentioned earlier the way that trans activists will plunder the past, I guess we could refer to it, you know, pillage the past in search of some justification for their identity in the present. But in its most extreme form, that kind of plundering of the past can take the shape of trans activists saying that, well, we were targets of the Holocaust as well, to take the history of the Holocaust. We were targeted by Nazi violence just like the Jews were. And the consequence of that is both, firstly, it's a very transparent attempt to lend moral legitimacy to an identity in the present by, I guess, stealing valor from the suffering of the past. But it also erases the historical truth of the Holocaust, the historical truth of the Nazi crusade against the Jews of Europe. So there's a real problem, isn't there, with not only the effect this war on the past has on what we are today, but even on our ability to know what happened in the past in a real truthful sense.
Yeah, I mean, I talk about the emergence of historical amnesia, where essentially through detaching society from its past and through doing everything possible to turn the past into a no-go area, an area that's seen to be dangerous and contaminated, almost to the point that you could put a quarantine on it. Under those circumstances, what you have is people forget some very important experiences. And although things are written down and there are still some old history books in existence, by and large, people begin to have a memory of, for example, the Holocaust, which is very different than the real Holocaust, because the kind of identitarian version of the Holocaust is one where, for example, Jewish people play a fairly minor, undistinguished part, but you have horses and all kinds of identity groups all suffering to a much greater extent than anybody else did. And the Holocaust then becomes this ensemble where different identity groups can claim that, you know, that they were its principal victims. Yeah. That kind of sort of weird sort of queering of the Holocaust is something that we're seeing gaining strength. So there is a struggle for historical memory here, because in the course of erasing important achievements of the past, what you're doing is you're encouraging people to forget what the past was really all about. And, you know, there's that famous quote from Orwell, right? He argues about how, you know, sort of this guy, you know, from the Ministry of Truth makes the point that by 2050, people will no longer remember who Shakespeare was, no longer remember who all the important philosophers were. They will simply not know the writings and the arguments of all these great figures from the past. That was he kind of predicted that in 2050. We're running ahead of that at the moment, right? We're a good 20, 25 years ahead of that time, and already we're seeing a situation where we no longer remember what Aristotle is, because we're told that Aristotle is this founder of white supremacy. And we're told all these stories where essentially a kid going to school today will be told that Churchill is a war criminal or was a war criminal. And when you have that kind of vision of the greatest icon of 20th century British history, then you don't remember very much about where you've come from.
Yeah. Definitely. In relation to the Holocaust, I remember a few years ago, the Socialist Workers' Party handed out a leaflet raising awareness about the Holocaust, which they described as an attack on disabled people, LGBT people, and gypsies. And they forgot to mention the Jews. They just completely forgot, which I think is what eventually happens when you turn the Holocaust into some kind of identity situation rather than a historical event. I wanted to ask you about how you understand the role of decolonization in relation to all of this. And of course, I'm using decolonization in its modern usage to describe, I guess, the cleansing of certain texts and ideas and old white men from syllabuses and so on in schools and universities, not the traditional meaning of decolonization, which was an important kind of post-war process of formerly colonized states gaining their freedom and independence. How do you see decolonization? I mean, presumably that is a key part of the war against the past, where you have a situation where, you know, you can have Kant taken off of the philosophy reading list because he's problematic, and his replacement by, I don't know, some kind of Zen Japanese thinker or something like that. That's an extreme form, but this is happening. You know, Chaucer is off and Alice Walker is in on the kind of English reading lists. That really cuts to the heart of what you're talking about, doesn't it? Which is that this is not just a war on the awful things that happened in the past, which everyone agrees would not be appropriate today, but also on the thinkers, the great thinkers, the people who provided the building blocks for the civilization that we all inhabit. So decolonization, how do you see that, its role in the war on the past?
Well, I see decolonization as just another name for de-civilization, because I think it's through decolonization that most of the civilizational achievements of humanity become contaminated and basically demonized and discredited. And it's, you know, decolonization begins in the universities in a very kind of targeted way. It then gradually expands, and basically everybody who is white and European becomes a potential target of decolonization. And then gradually decolonization acquires this sort of form where through its claim that everything in the world is racialized, you know, you can have a situation where you want to decolonize the desks in a classroom because the way the desks are set up is very white. And you want to decolonize the way that buildings are constructed. You can have arguments about decolonizing architecture and making sure that the paint, the way you paint the walls is not in a white racist kind of a way, but something else. So after a while, this kind of de-civilizational dynamic that it contains acquires its own imperative. And that's what we're seeing today, where decolonization both racializes everything, but in the course of racializing everything, also calls into question their integrity. So it's a, you know, it's one of the most, it's a medium through which a lot of this corrosive tendencies that we've been discussing spreads and gains momentum. And there's very few people at the moment who are prepared to call decolonization out and expose its kind of very reactionary, destructive sort of impulse.
Yeah. Another thing you touch on, you mentioned this in your recent Daily Mail piece where you introduced some of the themes of the book. You talk about the importance of the manipulation of language as well as the manipulation of memory or the obsession with the wicked past. And it did make me think, because you mentioned earlier that you have a situation where a trans activist in 2024 will say that, you know, don't misgender someone dug up from ancient Egypt, which is obviously preposterous, and most people would probably see that as preposterous. You know, there were men and women back then, just as there are men and women now. But there's also the more recent encroachments on, I guess you could call it historical memory or just social memory, community memory. So, for example, the unpopularity of using a word like mother, you know, we're supposed to say birthing parent, or even breastfeeding has become a problematic term. You have to say chest feeding in certain NHS zones. They actually do use that new language. Husband and father are now problematic terms, wife and mother, all of these kind of terms, which were are the terms through which families and communities understand and identify themselves, have become problematized to a certain extent. You tell the funny story where you were visiting your ailing mother in hospital and the hospital officials insisted that, no, you're her carer, not her son. And that kind of seemingly subtle but actually quite profound shift in how we use language and understand our own roles in the world is very important. How do you see that manipulation of language feeding into the broader hostility to the past or the de-civilization process that you're talking about?
Well, the narrative on language is always prefixed by the word outdated. So they use the word, this is an outdated word or an outdated vocabulary or language. And the very, if you look at the term outdated, you know, its use is not like when you buy jar of yogurt and you say that this yogurt is outdated now because its sell-by date has gone, what you're really saying is that this particular word is a word that we shouldn't use because it somehow offends people, it somehow is not inclusive. So it's ideologically sort of unacceptable. And I think the one of the most important accomplishments of the war against the past, it has gone some way towards taking control over the way we use our language. And the way we use our language, is, from their point of view, isn't just simply to substitute one word for another, but to bring in words that directly counter, that are antithetical to the kind of ideals that prevailed in human society for centuries. And in particular, if you notice, they are extremely working overtime in relation to the vocabulary that you use to describe interpersonal relations, relations between people. Because one of the things that occurs is that if you're talking about partners instead of husbands and wife, if you're talking about carers instead of sons, if you can no longer talk about mothers and brothers and sisters, then what you're doing is you're, in a sense, rendering every relationship opaque, you're kind of flattening them out. And the specificity of that relationship, which is so important, me as your brother or me as your lover, is lost altogether. It becomes more or less on par with that of a so-called carer, who could be a professional carer getting a wage, rather than anybody that's remotely linked to you. So the language is insidiously dangerous because it basically, the more we accept the language that they demand that we use, the more they are able to colonize our internal life and alter the way we think about the most intimate dimensions of our experience.
Yeah, that's well put. And I was recently reading an article about polyamory, the rise of polyamory in certain circles in the US and elsewhere, and they were referring to their primary partner and their secondary partner, and it was just such a depressing article, the way people talk about their lives and what might previously have been their loved ones or their lovers, and it's all become so technical and dispiriting. I wanted to press you a little bit on how this all plays out in the political realm, in politics. And you mentioned earlier that, you know, we have very few governments these days or political movements that have a clear vision for the future or big ambitions for the future. And I think people will relate to that. That's very true. But just I wanted to briefly take you back to the 1990s, because that was, I think, an important time for a political battle over the past. And you wrote a very interesting book at the time called Mythical Past, Elusive Future, where you looked at the meaning of history, the role of history, the use and abuse of history. And one thing I remember about the 90s is that there was, on the one hand, there was this kind of very, there was an obsession with the victories of the Second World War, particularly VE Day and VJ Day. And it seemed like for certain sections of society, particularly those on the right or the conservative, more people in the conservative project, there was this continual looking to the wonders of the Second World War and the great victories that we enjoyed as a means of getting some moral authority in the present that they otherwise lacked. And then you had this creeping new political movement, I guess represented by Blairism and the rise and rise of technocracy, which defined itself very much in opposition to the past. You know, we're brand new, we're going to do something completely different, the bad old days are over, things can only get better. And that did seem like a very important moment in terms of the battle over history. I think I was probably quite cynical about the obsession with the Second World War back then, but I do now look back with misty eyes that at least we were talking about something important from history back in the 90s. How do you understand the clashes in the 90s, which you talked about and wrote about at the time, in terms of the impact that they had on the war against the past that's playing out much more widely now?
Well, I think you can call that a rear guard battle, where sections, and as it happens, relatively small sections of the more conservative-minded politicians and members of the conservative establishment were desperate to find some way of ensuring that their legacy that they felt was quite important, was to some extent a source of celebration. And it was very sad that the only legacy that they could draw on was the victory of the Second World War, which, of course, was a tremendous achievement. And, you know, I'm all for celebrating what was achieved in that war. But it was very much a defensive battle. They were very much on the defensive, and they were not able to find a reply, a response to the technocratic dynamic, the technocratic mission, which continually emphasized novelty, and that everything that was new was by definition better than anything that was old. And at that stage in time, you know, sort of this, the fascination with creating a new Britain, you know, sort of a new cool Britain and a new kind of America and other kind of societies was of such power that the ideological battle to keep hold of at least elements of the past was pretty much lost. And that's really an interesting story itself, what happens in the 1990s. By the time you get to the 21st century, if you look at the celebrations of the around with the Millennium Dome and all these things, you'll find that a very important shift has occurred where our culture becomes increasingly uprooted for anything that has gone on beforehand. And it's at that particular moment in time that the past ceases to be an object of affection, an object of nostalgia, a focus of thinking the good old days that has gone on, but instead becomes this alien territory.
Yeah, I remember that really well, and the kind of the cult of the new and the cult of youth and all these various weird things that were happening around the same time as the Blair Project was in the ascendancy, and the problematization of older people, older generation, older ways of thinking, older ways of speaking, clampdowns on old blokes using the word darling and doll and sweetheart. All those, I think, were early signs of this kind of quite profound turn against history and against the past and against anything that felt old. All right, Frank, my last question for you is just on staying on politics for the last question, just how you see the war against the past playing out in relation to current government we have, the Starmer government, or just Western politics more broadly in the next few years. So, you know, if you think about like when Rishi Sunak left those D-Day celebrations early, lots of people said it was a blunder. I think it was actually more serious than that and probably was indicative of a politician just being unaware of the importance of history, the importance of a ceremony to celebrate an very important historical event that defines our nation. That was quite, I think, an eye-opener as to how some of these presentist technocratic politicians tend to think. Now we have the Starmer government, which I must say, I just find this government really depressing. It's not even that they make me particularly angry. It's just that I find it such a depressing project. They don't seem to have not only any visions for the future, but any desire to think about British history or what Britain represents or what the values of the nation might be. It's just an incredibly technocratic, possibly authoritarian, and as we know from Keir Starmer's speech this week, visionless government. So I guess my final question for you is, what happens to politics when we are disinherited from the past? Because it seems to me that politics becomes almost impossible unless the community has a sense of where it comes from and where it might be going to.
Yeah, I think under those circumstances, politics runs on empty and it becomes entirely a technocratic, procedurally oriented enterprise where you make rules about everything, but you're not really giving people any substantial choices, and you certainly are not providing people with the ideals that can inspire them, and particularly the younger generation. So we're moving into a situation where politics gets flattened out to the point at which it ceases to have any kind of meaning. Elections become, you know, very much a kind of a ritual, you know, about getting votes rather than about a clash of opinions. And the only antidote to that, the way you can somehow bring back an understanding of the importance of connecting, having an organic relationship with what preceded us is by trying to sort of promote a more sovereigntist nation-building approach, because you, in the moment you talk about the nation, the moment you talk about sovereignty and democracy, then invariably you have to make references to where those ideals come from. And you cannot have a sense of nation in the abstract. That sense of nation needs to be built upon something that kind of preceded it. And I think it's through promoting those kinds of ideals and the symbols that they're associated with, that you can begin to more effectively counter the contemporary trend. And I think that's a realistic possibility, because a lot of young people who feel lost would respond quite positively if they were exposed to a greater awareness of what has gone on, what's been remarkably important in the journey of human civilization, acquainting them with that exciting journey in a more systematic way can have a very big impact on their thinking. So there's a lot to fight for, but what is important is to not to compromise and to try to partake in the present political process on their terms, but to change the terms on which politics is going to move forward.
Frank, thank you very much.
Pleasure. Lovely to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe. And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.